Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Well, it's the kind of a post-disaster assessment you expect to hear from a survivor grasping at straws, or maybe a clergyman urging others to cling to the faith. They'll say something like, well, maybe some good can come of it. And you'd expect the economist or the urban planner to bite his lip at that line of reasoning. But there is a school of thought that says actually a disaster may help. Writing in the Boston Globe, Drake Bennett explores the topic. He looked at the recent Chinese earthquake, tried to find what economists were saying about development and disasters. Hello, Drake.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
So what got you to write the article? Was it this statement by the Chinese government about all the cash infusions that the earthquake was engendering, or was it just more of the notion that whenever you saw the disaster reporting from China or elsewhere, you would say in the back of your head, you know, some good could come of that?
I think the immediate hook was the report from the Chinese government. But I had heard about some other recent work by economists, and you know, it's not a consensus view among economists, but there are economists who argue that who've looked at both at the country level and at the smaller regional level, and come away thinking that actually it creates opportunities for growth, and that you see these if you compare different countries.
Yes. Now, a couple of researchers, Skidmore and Toya, found that in the case of climatic, so ones related to climate disasters like hurricanes and cyclones, but not earthquakes and volcanic eruptions, the more hurricanes and cyclones, the better. Nations with more climatic disasters grew faster over the long run than the less disaster prone. How could that be?
Well, their argument, there's a few parts to it. One is simply that in the wake of a disaster, you see money come in, public and private money. You see jobs being created to rebuild, construction jobs and otherwise. There's a fair amount of skepticism among some other economists about this because they say, well, this money, these jobs are things that just otherwise would have been put to other more productive use. But what Skidmore and Toya found that seems a bit more immune to that argument is that the growth actually resulted from the fact that the disaster was sort of clearing away old and outdated infrastructure and allowing more productive, efficient stuff to be built in its place.
And is there a reason that, you know, a hurricane would do that but an earthquake wouldn't? Would be more efficient in terms of, you know, clearing out the old and outdated?
I think they're both equally destructive. I think what Skidmore told me when I talked to him was that what he thought was that we're right now better at predicting things like hurricanes than things like earthquakes, and so hurricanes can be made less lethal. And the key for him are disasters that destroy infrastructure and property but don't kill as many people because the intellectual capital, he thinks, is more valuable and more resilient.
Now, you talked just there in your answer about the infusion of capital. Naomi Klein wrote a whole book about it called The Shock Doctrine. Her thesis, you referred to it in your article, mm-hmm. was that after a disaster, these capitalists come in and try to take advantage. Did any of your economists look at that?
No, they don't tend to address the Klein hypothesis as much. I mean, I think what an economist who is more skeptical about this idea would say is he'd refer to something called the broken windows fallacy, which is basically a 150-year-old parable that a French economist named Frédéric Bastiat came up with, which is basically the story of a store. And the window gets broken, and someone comes by and says, well, you're lucky your window got broken because it'll create work for the guy who's going to make you a new window. So there's this idea among economists that, you know, you're basically robbing Peter to pay Paul.
Yeah, this is it's easy to measure spending. You know, people have to pay taxes. It's easy to measure even income. It's harder to measure wealth. So after a disaster, you'll always see the statistics about the infusion of cash. I never see the statistic about what about the underlying wealth of the people in the affected region.
Right. No, that's definitely a problem with some of this research. And I think the researchers would admit that, you know, there's plenty of work still to be done here. They're still looking at a pretty crude scale. I mean, I think there is some evidence, though, that you can see, for example, increased innovation in the wake of disasters in certain kinds, in countries sort of at a certain stage of development, say like a Brazil or a South Africa.
Right, but a country like Bangladesh, which just keeps getting hit by hurricanes and typhoons, it just seems like they can't get out from under.
Yeah, and I think there's a question of sort of whether the aid that comes in is getting balanced by the fact that sort of the private money is sort of rushing for the exits in these countries where the you know it's hard to sort of make an investment that doesn't get sort of destroyed.
One of the inherent difficulties, if I were an economist measuring this, is that you don't measure a disaster hit country versus their non-disaster hit counterpart. You kind of have to try to measure it against itself. Like, what would have happened if the disaster hadn't hit? That seems really hard. How do economists get around that?
Well, I think what they try to sort of find, they get a large data set and they try to find countries that look enough like each other that they can sort of make meaningful comparisons. But yeah, of course, I mean, the ultimate problem here is that you're sort of comparing things to a counterfactual.
Right. And mostly you focused on natural disasters. What about terrorist attacks? What about, you know, there is a school of thought that said Japan's economy was helped by massive bombings in Tokyo and Hiroshima and Nagasaki.
Right.
Has anyone been looking at that?
Well, I think that's actually the precedent for this work looking at natural disasters comes out of some of the work, the surveys of the damage to Japan and the impact on the economy that were carried out right after World War II, and also some of the work that researchers at RAND did looking at these sort of chilling sort of models of what the United States would look like after a nuclear attack. And I think the arguments are similar. I mean, I think on the one hand, you have people who say that there is this sort of weird, perverse spur to growth, and then other people who say, no, destroying things is not a good strategy for growth, no matter what is doing it.
Yeah, you quote one economist who says, over any reasonably relevant period of time, society is not made wealthier by destroying resources. If it were, Beirut would be one of the wealthiest places in the world, to which I'd add the Iranian city of Bam and Bangladesh and Johnstown, Pennsylvania.
Right, sure. Yeah, I mean, I think that's something you'll hear from a lot of economists. There's there is a fair amount of skepticism about this work because of this idea that you're destroying things and then claiming it's helped the economy, and also because, as you said, it's hard to measure the effects reliably and over a meaningful span of time of something like a natural disaster.
There also is, to me, to reading it, a sort of how dare you aspect to even posing the question. Of course, an academic has to pose the question. But there seems to, for people who adhere to this theory, almost the assumption that everything that was cleared away was the weakest stuff that deserved to be cleared away, this, you know, self-fulfilling Darwinistic prophecy, that's not always the case. I mean, sometimes a disaster hits and a perfectly good road or bridge or, you know, housing complex gets destroyed.
Right, that's true. I think what the way in which someone like Skidmore explains the results he saw, and again, these are sort of, this is sort of coming out of quantitative work. So he saw this effect, and then he's tried to explain it. And also researchers who've looked, for example, at the aftermath of the Great Alaska Earthquake in the 60s was that, yes, not everything that was cleared away was sort of decrepit and ripe for replacement, but there is this way in which once you have this, clean slate, then these sort of decisions to replace things that weren't happening because of, you know, politics or sort of bureaucratic sclerosis are basically rendered moot because you have to replace it. So the point isn't that all the bad stuff necessarily was surgically picked out by the earthquake, but that you have a chance to replace the good and the bad stuff with new good stuff.
Right. It does give you the opportunity. Sometimes the opportunity is squandered. I mentioned Johnstown, Pennsylvania. You know, in 1900, and that was after the Great Flood there in the late 19th century, the population was something like 75,000. Now it's around 20,000. They kept rebuilding the city, and it kept getting flooded.
Right. And I think, even people who look at sort of regional effects in the U.S. and see, you know, after Hurricane Andrew or after the Northridge earthquake in California, see growth after that, even those people would say Katrina, for example, has not been a great source of growth for the area because everyone left. The insurance payouts were very slow in coming. The government aid was very slow in coming. And so even on this regional level,
right,
you didn't see it after Katrina.
That's right. And talking about what you mentioned before, that, you know, incomes rise and that broken windows theory, I was down there doing some reporting and talking to an LSU economist. The tax rolls were great. Everyone had to go out and rebuy everything for their home. But he warned the government, do not rely on this because it's going to dry up in the long run.
Right.
You get the one-time spike. This is, I thought, the most interesting thing to take away from your article. Kind of look at the lesson of a disaster, see how it can be a chance to restart, and perhaps a good city planner can apply that to a non-disaster setting. Could you talk about that a little bit, what disasters can teach us?
Sure. I mean, I think basically it's simply this idea that, that we shouldn't be afraid to replace stuff, that we should not be afraid to sort of look, take sort of a cold, hard look at sort of efficient infrastructure and inefficient infrastructure, and try to not hold on to stuff simply for sort of sentimental value. For example, in Alaska after the Great Alaskan Earthquake, there researchers who looked at that found that the fishing fleet was much more was much more efficient because they had sort of put in all these new ships and they could go further and bring in a bigger catch, or the pressure to sort of build quickly meant that the construction industry got much more innovative and effective. So, I mean, I think it's sort of hard to sort of impose that sort of pressure on oneself, but I think that is the lesson. That's the sort of way to take these this idea of the benefits of disasters and try to impose them in the absence of a catastrophe.
Drake Bennett, Boston Globe reporter and somewhat of a master of disaster. Thank you very much, Drake.
Thanks a lot.